Hey folks, welcome to Florida Uncut, the podcast all about the people behind the connection and protection of wild Florida. Today is our last episode of the four-part series that we're doing with Archbold Biological Station in Buck Island Ranch. And I started with Hillary Swain. You can go back and listen to those episodes. But today, we're going back to Archbold to talk with their Headwaters Ecosystem Management Team Lead, Alicia Dietrich. That's a long title. What does that mean? Well, I like to sum it up as all-around badass. Alicia does so many things through that role. Kind of what we're focusing on today is leading the regional fire management efforts to restore and maintain those critical ecosystems and also reduce the risk of uncontrolled wildfires all throughout the Everglades Headwaters and the Lake Wells Ridge. And Alicia comes from a background of doing this with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, as well as being a biologist. So she understands not only the role of fire in Florida's ecosystem, but also the ecosystem itself. And really during this conversation, her knowledge, her experience, her enthusiasm shines through. This is her first podcast ever, and she absolutely crushed it. It was so much fun. She just seems like such a great person to work with. And we talk about what it's like to do her role, but also the importance of fire. I used to live out west, and wildfires were just a yearly occurrence in the summer. I mean, your plans were disrupted constantly, from backpacking and camping trips to drive across the mountains. You know, there were always fires. And at the worst, you know, your community or your life could be threatened. And I remember thinking, like, man, I just never remember this happening as a kid. And maybe it was because Florida's a lot more wet a lot of the year, and which is true. And there were a few times that wildfires were a thing, and we had some concern, but not at that rate and at that scale. And what I've come to learn is that Florida has been a leader, and it has had this history and this culture of fire management or land management through the role of prescribed fire, far beyond and far ahead of so many other places around the country. And so, you know, I didn't know that. It's almost like out of sight, out of mind, and it's a good thing that we didn't. It's almost like, you know, when you do a good job sometimes, no one will notice, and that's a good thing. And that's how I feel about folks like Alicia. You know, we don't hear about this a lot because they do such a good job managing these fires and keeping them consistent, you know, every couple years burning land to keep that potential out-of-control fuel down. And that's just one reason we do fire. But if you want to learn more and have an entire day revolved around prescribed fire and its understanding, please join us Saturday, November 8th at Highlands Hammock State Park in Sebring for the first ever Lake Wells Ridge Fire Fest. There's going to be live demonstrations of wildfires. There's going to be equipment like helicopters and trucks and all the stuff that goes along with fire management, as well as the people and the stories. It's going to be really hands-on, family-friendly. I'm going to be there with my kids. And at 1 o'clock on the stage, we're going to do a live podcast recording of Florida Uncut with a panel of burn boss experts, which includes Alicia. And bring your family. I think the cost is just the entrance to the state park, which is like $5 or $6, and you're in for the day. And then you can actually watch a fire as well. We're going to do a live demonstration of a fire. So thank you, Alicia, for joining. Thank you so much again for Zach Franco, who was featured in the last bonus episode, who helped coordinate all these conversations, as well as Talia Warwick, who helped do this as well. And also Madison Jantz, who has helped with coordinating and posting as well at Archbold's side. So thank you to the whole team. This isn't going to be it. We've already talked about who's next we could feature from Archbold. There's just so many people. It's a goldmine of podcast conversations. And lastly, Adam Baring here at the Florida Wildlife Corridor Foundation. He's our Corridor Connect Plus intern. He has taken the role of editing over for me. So this is his first podcast episode he's edited for Florida Uncut. And if you know anything about podcasting, editing is like the lion's share of the work. Interviews are fun. Interviews are easy. But editing is really where the work is. And it's sometimes I just don't have the time. And so now with his help, we're able to post more often. And so this is the first episode he's done. So super excited to post it. And if you have any feedback, please reach out to me, mason@floridawildlifecorridor.org. Yeah, I thought he did a really good job. And thank you so much, Adam. All right, let's go ahead and dive in. Welcome to Florida. See, I'm nervous too. Welcome to Florida Uncut, Alicia. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. How you doing?
I'm doing good. So you were talking to me a little bit before, but what? Where are you coming from? Where are you in right now? Are you at home?
So, yeah, right now I'm at home in the kitchen, taking advantage of a little bit of a quiet, relaxing time between all of the calls for fire assistance and treating Ligodium.
Oh my gosh. So you burned, you said, a couple 12-hour days this week. When is the burn season in Florida? It's always the dry season, but that's not right now, right?
No, right now we're in the wet season. It really just depends on the conditions of your habitat and all that, but to really just make it broad, all year is burn season in Florida.
Yeah.
If you want to address your fires in a better ecological manner, then the best time to burn is around lightning season, which, ironically enough, you wouldn't think it, but during the rainy season is when you should be burning if you want to do good ecological management.
Really? So what about the dry season? You also burn then too. Is that historically things? I mean, I assume that's when most of the fires would be burned naturally, but you're saying really in Florida, it could be any time. It all depends on.
Yeah.
I'm sure
yeah.
Year to year it can change.
Exactly. If you speak to some botanical purists, the burn period is May 1 to July 15. And like, that's it. And that follows because in May, you have the highest drought index. We call it the KBDI. It's the Keenan-Beacham Drought Index. And that is a big factor that we consider when we're planning our burns.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, it came right up too, KBDI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not too many. That's one of the few acronyms where it's pretty much the only one that's got
yeah,
it.
There's no, I was going to say, I was like, what else could that be? I mean, I don't even know. So, wow. Wow, that's really neat. I'm going to put that in the show notes so people can look it up. But sorry, cut off.
Yeah, no, you're good. It's a great indicator, especially for residents to understand. You know, if you want to do some pile burning or burning of yard debris, anything like that, it behooves you to look at the drought index prior to applying that fire, because then you know or have a better understanding of what are the chances that this fire could run away from me. And if the drought index is based from 0 to 800, with 0 being Florida's underwater and 800 being all of Florida is on fire, every single square inch. And so if you have a drought index of like 700, I would not recommend burning. You have some pretty extreme conditions, high drought index, that will tell you that, you know, everything's crispy and you could flick a cigarette or just breathe some hot air on it and it'll probably ignite.
Holy cow. So what are you looking for? What's kind of the number that's like the sweet spot?
Generally, and it all comes back to what you're burning. So if I want to burn scrub has naturally had extreme conditions to burn. And extreme is very subjective. But when you speak about the habitat types that you can find in Florida, scrub requires lower humidities, generally higher winds, and generally a higher drought index. So if you're pretty much all of what you can burn in Florida, you can burn from a drought index of 200 to like, I mean, you could burn at a drought index of 700. I wouldn't suggest it. Yeah. I think it's taking quite the risk, but, you know, it'll burn at a drought index of 700. But generally speaking, yeah, somewhere around 200-300 drought index to about 600. And then beyond that, you're going to run into, if the drought index is higher than 600, regulatory agencies kind of putting a halt on any burn authorizations because of the high risk for wildfires and your fire escaping from you.
Holy cow. So when people ask you what you do, what's kind of like your elevator pitch answer? If you're like, hey, Alicia, what do you do?
Set stuff on fire and kill plants.
Okay. And they're like, please, you are, put your hands behind your back. You're an arson and a plant murderer.
I'm a paid pyromaniac.
That's right. That's right. Holy cow. So that's, I mean, that has to just blow people's mind when they find that about you, just because it's like, that's, there's not many of you, I can imagine. Just mixed out there with the public.
It takes a special kind of crazy to enjoy being out in the Florida summer next to a fire and actively lighting more fire. But yeah, you can't, personally, I say you can't beat it. I think it is the most fun. And when you go back and you see the results a few months, a few years later, you see the plants that are coming back, the wildlife that are taking advantage of all the different periods of time post-burn. I love it.
That's awesome. Well, how did you get into this? Where did your career start that led to managing fires and these teams and these really, really cool processes of recreating these natural processes in real time? Where did it start? You know, you don't start with the drip torch in your hand, I don't think. Maybe you do.
Some people are lucky enough. I actually grew up in a very urban area. I grew up in Orlando, ironically enough. And I knew that I wanted some kind of like animal-based career. And so when I went to college, I actually went in as a pre-vet, and I intended on becoming a veterinarian because I was like, oh yeah, animals, veterinarian, done. I didn't have really much of any exposure to habitat management and land management prior to that. I was at orientation with my family for when I transferred in. And within, I don't know, the first hour, I turned to my parents and I'm like, I made a mistake. I don't want to be pre-vet. This isn't what I thought it was. And at the time, I was a little disheartened because, as I understood it, transferring in, you're locked in. You cannot change your degree. And so I started doing my course load, just kind of generally planning, like, how can I take this current degree and use it for something else? Through a series of events and all that, I was able to change my major to wildlife ecology and conservation. And that was really, I was reviewing the available degrees, and I looked at the course load to each of the degrees and saw so many interesting classes related to wildlife ecology. And that's what kind of piqued my interest. And then as I went through the wildlife ecology program, I fell more and more in love with this line of work. And then beyond that, you know, that gave kind of a studious approach to land management. And then I was able to get some practical application through volunteering with the Ridge Rangers. Yeah, that really opened my eyes to just how diverse land management and that line of work is.
Isn't it interesting? You pursue something thinking, you know, okay, here's what I want to do, which is oftentimes like the only job you know about that line of work. It's like the kids that want to be pro athletes or something. You pursue that with, you know, a 0.001% chance. But as you do through playing the sport or whatever it is, pursuing that passion, you realize, oh my gosh, there's all these other opportunities. They need like data analysts and physical therapists. And there's like all kinds of, there's equipment you can sell. There's like every kind of job is almost in every kind of thing. Once you start following it, you see that. Not from the outside, you don't see that. So that started happening with you. What was what were some of those things that started to kind of come into view? Because that's how I think about conservation. Like, you have this idea, but as you get into it, and as I talk to more people like you, you realize, wow, there's really everything here. you know, all these organizations like an Archbold or a TNC or anywhere, they need a bit of all of that. You know, they need marketers and accountants and all the stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Big time. It takes many hands in order to make a ship get on through the ocean,
that's right.
Get on through the water.
Or burn it down.
It takes a really like diverse skill set too, because I appreciate the foundation that I got with my education to be able to better understand. I had no frame of reference. You know, I didn't live the land. I didn't work the land growing up. So I didn't get that in-depth involvement in just kind of sitting and watching how the world works around me. And so when I got that kind of baseline and I was able to apply that and view the landscape and understand it a little bit better, and then as I was going through it, be able to work it better. But like what they didn't really teach you, or they kind of hinted at, was so much of land management. Yeah, you need to know your wildlife, but you need to know your plants. You need to know how to work equipment, and you need to know how to fix it and get yourself out of sticky situations. I never thought that I would be able to work with portable pumps or figure out, you know, open this valve, close this one. All right, if I'm going to winch myself out, I need to make sure that I put like a blanket over this, maybe a counterweight over here. All right, now I got a rocket, and then I can jet on out of this little hole that I'm in.
Wow.
It's a lot of fun, because it feels like every day you're learning something new, and you feel, and I feel like I'm becoming a much more well-rounded person because of my exposure to all of these diverse situations.
That is cool. That is neat. So you know, when you're not burning, what else are you doing? What are some of those things that are like out in the field? I know that probably gets all the attention and the glory in your line of work, but it's like, you know, it's, I work in conservation and a lot, and I come from the corporate world, and honestly, a lot of days are kind of similar to that backline. I'm like, it's not that different as far as the tasks at hand and how you're doing your work online and whatnot. What are those things you're doing when you're not out there on a burn?
If we're not burning, you know, the current position that I work in, it is grant funded work. And there are two objectives to my grant: help get fire on the ground and treat old world climbing fern, also known as Lygodium microphyllum. Yeah, I joke that I'm a herbicide jockey in my spare time. But it comes down to, we try to target known locations, but occasionally we'll survey. But you mix up your herbicide, you take your truck and you go on out and get as close to your location as you can. The fun part is Lygodium loves growing in swamps. So we generally have to then take these 3-gallon backpack sprayers, get all our gear that we need for the day, and then hike on out to wherever needs to be treated.
And what's the target? You can see it with kudzu or something, like growing over a landscape. So I assume that's like the low-hanging fruit. You can see exactly where it is. Is that what you target when it's really established? Or are you trying to find it when it's barely getting started?
It's a combination of both. With exotic plants or invasive plants, there is the best way to ensure you're controlling them is through early detection and rapid response, EDRR. And so if you're getting these small incipient populations, you're better ensuring that that area doesn't grow and that it's not contributing to the spread of this invasive plant. But when you have established populations, you have a very real source that is contributing to the spread. And it's a bit like a bell curve, except like, you know, the first half, in that once a population gets established, or it's an exponential curve, there we go. once it gets established, it usually it's a compounding factor, because as it gets bigger, it's got more spores to send out and distribute into places. So currently we're really targeting, well, we pretty much will target just about anything, any populations of Lycodium, I should say. So big, small, doesn't matter. I'm really excited because currently at this very moment, we're targeting a population of Lycodium that has resprouted post-fire on a burn that we did. So it feels like we're doing the management that everybody really aspires to do, but oftentimes you don't have like the time or resources in order to do it. We got essentially the initial treatment with that fire, and now those below ground reserves are expressing. And so therefore it's reducing all of those below ground reserves because it's putting all that effort above ground, and we go in and we spray it. So it's like a 1-2 punch.
Yeah, that makes sense. Wow. That really makes sense. Like, so it's using all these resources, but then, you know, you pull that, you take it out and that's it. Like that's ideally like you've
hopefully we won't need to. Yeah. Hopefully we won't have to go out there and retreat. You know, I say like, hoping that exotics, invasive plant work is a never ending job. You'll never get rid of all of the invasive plants. And the joke is that you'll never be without work. And some people say that to try and soothe any kind of fears of job stability and all that. But I sit there and I say, if I can treat myself out of the job, I will be ecstatic. I will be crowing to all the four corners of this earth, right, saying, I did it.
And then you can be like all those corny pyramid scheme folks on Instagram that like, now buy my course to learn how you can do it too. You have that in your future if you successfully treat this. So you'll have a future in the work regardless. So, you know, it's so interesting. Land management is something I try to feature on this show, you know, consistently or time again, and just talk about it. You know, that seems from the outside looking in, the biggest thing is invasive species management as well as fire, you know, prescribed burns. What are some of those other big categories of land management from your point of view? Those are the two you focus on. What else?
Oftentimes in land management, you will need to employ some sort of like heavy mechanical treatments to an area. Sometimes you'll be plowing lines or establishing fire breaks because you are a lot of the heavy mechanical treatment in my eyes is in order to facilitate application of prescribed fire. So I'm going to create a fire break using that heavy equipment. I may mow the edges with like a brush hog or other kind of cutting piece of equipment. And that oftentimes is done to mitigate the fire behavior near the edge of the unit, better ensuring security of your fire to stay in the bounds as described. You can also take that heavy equipment and do interior mechanical treatments to the vegetation. Personally, I prefer a lighter touch when I work the area. Most of the work can be accomplished with fire, depending on the state of the unit that you're working, though you might just bite the bullet and do the mechanical treatment. If you have a heavy fuel load, or just an impossible situation surrounding you, such as like infrastructure or anything like that, that'll make you want to go in there and set yourself up better for success.
Right. Yeah, just to create a really solid fire break so nothing gets out of hand, maybe around a building or something, or something that might be susceptible to heat. So I'm super curious. So with fire, to me, that's like the most charismatic thing y'all do. It's so cool to watch. Anytime, you know, I was just up in Apalachicola National Forest, and we come about prescribed fire they were doing, and me and my family were on spring break, and we just were like, let's stop and watch this for like half an hour. And the kids were all super stoked. I mean, and these flames were huge. And I don't really know how it all works. I've seen it. You know, we talk about it a lot in country. I've never been a part of a fire. And I'll be honest, I grew up on some land with my grandparents in Central Florida, not far from Archbold, about 45 minutes or so north on the ridge. And we would often have trees to burn or something to burn. And I'll be honest, every time we did, it was chaotic. It was scary. It was way too big. And I remember thinking, like, this could go wrong really fast. And so, you know, I've always been kind of blown away by prescribed fires and the entire concept. And then I lived out west for about a decade, and it was a really bad time to be there with how out of control fires were getting from California to Colorado. And a lot of people come to Florida maybe with that mindset or maybe with that understanding of just fires in the woods. I don't know. Just give us some overview generalizations of like, why is it important? Most of the listeners on the show are probably going to know, like, at least I'm probably going to be on the lower end of our understanding. Most people are going to know and going to understand why we need it. But like, how would you describe it to the public? We can start really basically and say, why is this important?
Florida thrives on fire. And it honestly isn't just Florida. Many other places do require fire. The stigma against it is that if you don't burn it for a long time, that fuel isn't going anywhere. And so unless you take certain steps to mitigate it, you will have a catastrophic fire. And so Florida has just had a long history of fire management, either through cultural burning, such as the First Nations peoples, or through wildfires. And so there hasn't been altogether great opportunity for those fuel loads to accumulate here. And therefore, we've not had the same stigma and perspective against fire on the landscape. Florida has a lot of, majority of the habitats here are pyrogenic. They need fire in order to reproduce. For example, pine trees. They have, especially the sand pine, what are called serotonous cones, and that have a waxy coating on the outside of them. And so you cannot get them to release the seeds until that wax is melted off. Now, you know, there's the heat of Florida and all that can melt just about anything. So they do still find a way to reproduce, but it gives you some kind of evolutionary context and evidence to support the need of fire on Florida's landscape.
So that fire dependency is what a lot of these landscapes are. And do you find the influx of new folks to Florida or people from different parts of Florida where there just might not be fire possible because of or needed because of urban density that are coming to more rural settings? Are you finding that there's this misunderstanding with what y'all do or concerns around what y'all do? And not even folks that are new, but I was talking to a dairy farmer who's been in Central Florida, I mean, his whole life. And he was telling me about how in the property, he's one of my neighbors at my grandparents' house. He was talking to me about, you know, the land acquisition that the state bought some improved pasture and have restored it to Everglades Headwaters restoration program that was part of a wildlife management area that bought it like 10, 15 years ago. Well, anyway, a lot of it's mature enough now that they're starting to burn it. And he goes, can you believe? He's like, this is the craziest thing. He goes, this is the government spending for you. He goes, can you believe they would plant all these plants in this sandy area? And then he says, and then they burn it. He goes, and then they immediately I'm talking like 2 weeks later, they burn the whole place. And I'm thinking, and we're on the Lake Wales Ridge. I'm thinking, I guarantee that was a fire dependent species and that actually helped. And I told him that, and he was like, it was mind-blowing to him. And he's from here, you know what I mean? So what y'all are doing, I'm sure, is constantly in need of sharing and letting people know this is a good thing. This is healthy. This is what's supposed to happen. Do y'all have that friction a lot?
You're always going to get concerns, calls from neighbors, and some are just more concerned about, is this going to get on my property?
Right. Like, they know it's a thing. They just are like, hey, just making sure.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's why a lot of times we'll have like neighbor notifications and all that, just to be like, hey, no worries. You're going to see a plume. That's mine. You're welcome. Yeah. but we do, I do occasionally run into a few people that feel strongly enough to voice their opinion on what we're doing. It happens. Thankfully, Florida has some very strong laws and legislature that recognize that regardless of your opinion on whether or not this should burn, it will burn. And if we sit here and apply fire to an area under conditions that are more mitigated than when it would want to burn on its own, we are reducing the threat of catastrophic wildfire and potential infrastructure loss.
Yeah, that's and I will say, you know, from a public point of view, when we watched that fire in Apalachicola earlier this year, it's intimidating. I mean, it's a huge plume of smoke. It is some big flames. It is a lot of equipment and people running around. And if you just come upon it, it's a wild scene. And I'm sure you're like, that is like your bread and butter of what you love. But man, just being a part, seeing it is like, it can be scary, frankly, if you don't know that this is supposed to be happening.
It definitely can. And the one thing that I can maybe say to assuage anybody's fears is, if you're seeing people there, then that's probably the best thing you can have when there's a fire next to your house.
Yeah, if you don't see anybody, that's probably a bad sign. Well, take us through prep for a fire. So, you know, I want people to understand like kind of the work that goes into it, and then what, you know, say, I don't know how it's parcelized. I don't know how you keep track of. Is it certain around? You try to keep your parcels around a certain size. I know they can burn as small as, you know, a few acres. I saw recently Boyd Hill in St. Pete burned, and that's like a couple hundred acres, which is really cool. And I think it was the first time in years. And it was like this demonstration. What do y'all, how do you plan? Is, you know, do you keep track of on a map? Okay, this place burned a couple years ago. That's due next year. What goes into the prep of an area to burn?
Oh man, like you hit the nail on the head for one of the major considerations. Determining or calling out the fire history of not just the unit that you are intending on burning, but the surrounding units. To hear that Boyd Hill burned is great, because with them, their considerations are hugely the wildland urban interface. Those in the know, we call it the WUI, because it's fun to say and it's an acronym. But so wildland urban interface is a major factor that fire practitioners need to consider, because nobody, and I am guaranteeing this right now, nobody wants to burn down a house. Nobody wants to burn down infrastructure. And a burn boss is always hyper aware of that. And so whatever steps burn boss feels are necessary to mitigate that, they will generally take them, and they're not going to apply that fire until they know they can sleep at night knowing that that fire isn't going to burn anything down. When you're preparing a unit for fire, like just a general overview of burn planning and how you approach land management, specifically prescribed fire, you have to look at what the vegetation is within your units. You have to determine what your units are. If you have, the standard is a bare mineral soil fire break. So the Lake Wales Ridge is lucky enough to have to be an ancient coastal dune system. So we got that sand. So it's pretty easy to get down to bare mineral soil. Bare mineral sand really is what it is.
Yeah. Not really soil.
it is baffling. I've been working the ridge for 10 years now, and it is still baffling and astounding and admirable to me how the plants can just hang on there. They got the harshest conditions. They got fire coming at them, and they're like, yeah, give it to me.
Yeah. I've been here doing this.
So you want to identify a unit. You got to identify the vegetation within it, because that vegetation determines how your fire will move through the unit. What weather conditions that you need to be able to apply the fire in there and effectively push it through, but also ensuring that it doesn't just keep running. At Archbold, we're a research station. So a big emphasis is on studying the ecology of what's present there already, and then how things change, adapt, or come back after this management technique is applied to an area. So a big focus for us is the Florida scrub jay, the only bird endemic to Florida. It's a beautiful blue corvid, very gregarious. We love them. They like Florida scrub. They have specific requirements as to the height of the vegetation. That's one of the reasons we burn, is to mimic that kind of reset that happened naturally. There is silly bird that can't seem to, that don't do well when you start getting into your hammocking oaks, when you start to see the canopy go above 10, 15 feet or so. You have to apply that fire and reset it for them. So these are all kind of like, you got to think about what wildlife's in there, what vegetation's in there, what's surrounding you, what's the fire history, what's the condition of my fire breaks, do I even feel like I am capable of applying this fire here?
Really?
Yeah.
What goes into that? Is that like staff and equipment and
experience?
Experience. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. It's pretty well known that Florida scrub is the most particular when it comes to the conditions that it needs to burn. You got shrubby oaks that for some reason just like live in a pyrogenic area, but also just like hate fire. Like they resist it until you're in like a very high drought index. You have a lot of wind and low humidity. And then you're talking about tall flame lengths at Apalachicola. Like the flame lengths for scrub can be like 50 feet high.
Really? So everything has to burn. Holy cow. That is wild. So when I, you know, was doing research, there's a picture of you, a pretty famous picture of you in Highlands Hammock with like a totally charred background. And I think that's all saw palmetto and some pines. Scrub, it has to burn so hot and so high. How does it come back? Does everything tend to make it with all the oaks come back and everything?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the really neat thing about scrub, especially on the Lake Wales Ridge, but I mean, really anywhere, you need gaps. You actually have to have like a proper scrub has these white sandy patch openings kind of scattered throughout it. And the scrub jay, and this is bolstered by scrub jay behavior. They will take the acorns and cache them or hide them like squirrels in these white sand gaps. And that's how they are able to make it through winters, is they find these acorns later in the year and then they eat them. And so if you don't have your white sand gaps, then it's harder to support scrub jays and their persistence on your landscape. There are sub variants of Florida scrub ecosystems. for example, rosemary bald, this really cool little shrub. It has a distinctive smell to it. In fact, I've heard before that Archbold will use the smell of rosemary as a screening question because it can smell. And some people despise the smell, which I don't understand because I love the smell. Yeah. but that takes, I think, somewhere around 20, 30 years, maybe up to 50 to reach sexual maturity before it can reproduce. And so you're talking a fire return interval, or, you know, the period of time that you wait until you start to look at burning something, fire return interval, FRI, 50 years or so for a rosemary bald. So there are burners who have the opportunity to do essentially once in a lifetime fires by applying prescribed fire to these rosemary balds. Once in a lifetime, because they will not be able to apply fire there for another 50 years. And like, when you consider that and the other like habitat requirements and generally how things come back, it's astounding, because in 50 years, you're still looking at an area that has the canopy height is less than 10 feet. So in all of 50 years, stuff has only grown to a max height of like maybe 8 feet. And that is a bit of an exaggeration, because sand pines are always in play and those suckers know that they need to shoot up quick. But if you have that, my word of advice is to just cut down the sand pines and wait for those rosemary to start reproducing and then attack it with fire. But and that's mostly to ensure that you're better facilitating scrub jay reproduction and longevity on the landscape. but otherwise, like, you know, some other scrub types and all that, 8 to 15 years seems to be about the time when you burn them. And the oaks come back very quickly. They are very good at storing carbohydrates below ground, so that when the fire does come through, they just shoot right on back up. And they're like, you can't touch me, man. I got this. I was ready.
Wow. So you learn the fire history of a place. You kind of say you determine, I don't know, does that take a couple site visits, a couple weeks, months, a year to plan? And then, you know, what is the timeline of prepping an area for fire?
It really does come down to your program and the experience of the staff managing the area. Land management at its core is knowing the land, is doing your best to understand and listen to it and respond to what it's asking you to do. And prescribed fire is a big one to do that. With Archbold, we have been documenting the fire history in the area, I mean, effectively since like the 1920s, generally since the 1920s, but effectively since like the 90s, I want to say. Mm-hmm. So that is a huge boon, because if you don't know the fire history of the area, then you don't know what kind of fuel load you might have in there. The planning process is done in consultation with experts and others with local area knowledge. We want to ensure, because you're thinking about it, I want to make sure that I'm doing the best thing for my plants, for my animals, for my bugs, for like my community around me. And so you have to make sure that you bring in all of these people together so that they can lend their expertise and help you got everybody come together on what's best for the area.
Wow.
Yeah. Usually a lot of places will do an annual, you have like a long-term fire plan and then a very specific, I'm going to address these units with prescribed fire annual fire plan.
So once you've determined, okay, we need to burn you know, it's a matter of, I'm sure, a matter of waiting on the right conditions or having a general timeline. Is there, how soon out do you know that you can do the work? And then what could kind of change that plan? Like, I do have a background in the contracting world. Say we plan on painting this building. And so we've got to buy the paint and get everything. And then, you know, it's raining that day and we didn't expect. So we got to wait. Maybe there's some prep we can do, but we really got to wait to do the actual work. So how is that, what is that like for the work you do?
Once we've identified the units, and oftentimes the vegetation type is going to be the first thing that you look at, like flatwoods, I want to burn that every 2 to really 4 years. So like if it's due, it's on the map to burn. And so once you have hashed out with all the necessary players what units are identified for fire, you will then need to make sure that the unit is prepped and ready to go. The first and foremost thing is you want to make sure that your boundaries, the lines around your unit, are in suitable shape that you feel comfortable proceeding with the fire. And so we come back to disking to bare mineral soil is the general standard. So you go in there and you can, it depends on the habitat that you're prepping. If you have a flatwoods, you need to prep that closer to when you want to burn it, because it's so productive that if you prep it a year in advance, if you come back 1 year later, you sit there and you look around and you're like, what did I do? I don't right. see anything here.
Right. For the rosemary and the sand, it might be just as you left it a year ago.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Exactly. So you do your prep and you kind of frame that out for your prep prior to when you want to apply the fire. For myself, I really like burning in the summer. And that's to mimic the ecological processes, but it's also because the rain is pretty much the only thing that helps me sleep at night. Yeah. it's ironic. Like, you would think that the rain would stop you from being able to burn, but the rain is what charges me to burn, because Florida is so gosh darn hot enough, and there is just the right, like, vegetative fuel on the ground that I've seen it burn in the rain before.
Wow.
So I like burning in the summer so that if I have concerns for like duff or anything like that, the rain will put it out. So, but I digress. Identifying a unit and determining when to burn it. Once you have your fire, or like the timeline for burning, once you have your fire breaks prepped and ready to go, if there is any internal treatment of fuel that needs to be done, you'll want to do that. So if, for example, I have one of my lines is adjacent to a house, mm-hmm. you know, I don't need 10-foot vegetation right next to the house. Somebody could probably do that, not me. I would probably mow it down. And that's so that when those flames come through it, the flames are generally going to go above the top of the vegetation. So if my vegetation is 10 feet tall, well, my flames are going well over 10 feet.
Yeah.
So if I bring it down, then it's less likely that those flames can kind of reach out and lick that house. So any kind of like prep like that needs to be done. You can also, like, one of the things to consider is duff or muck. And you can think of
you've
duff.
Brought that up. I was going to say, what is that?
Duff is an accumulation of organic matter. So palmettos, you know, they got those dead fronds and they just go to the ground. Well, they keep producing those. They don't stop. The only thing, well, not the only thing, but the big thing in Florida that gets rid of them is fire. But if you don't have fire in an area, they just keep on piling up. And eventually you get it kind of like a compost pile. Like, that stuff on the bottom has broken down and it's like very organic soil. It still might have a little bit of like the look and feel of palmetto fronds, or pine needles are another big one. But the big takeaway is that it can burn. And if it burns, oftentimes you'll see similar effects like what you see with the fires out west, where you'll have trees and it looks like there's feet of earth, essentially, that has been burned away.
And that's just all that organic layer.
Yes.
Burning. And I'm sure it takes a long time to burn. Or can be sitting there smoldering forever.
Yes. Duff fires are fairly notorious because I've worked a few duff fires, wildfires before. And I remember very vividly, there was a spot that was probably a quarter acre in size. And in the heart of it, there was a pine tree that, oh my gosh, it was beautiful. I really feel sorry for that poor tree. It was like 50-foot tall pine tree. I couldn't wrap my arms around it. And when I was out there in that specific area working that duff fire, I was eye level with where the base of the tree was. And so all I was seeing was the tap roots and all the feeder roots around me. And we spent, I want to say, a month and a half to 2 months in that quarter acre every day, dumping water on it, thousands of gallons. And the only thing that put it out was the summer rains.
Holy God.
So a duff fire is just code for you don't have a life until you get rain.
Wow. That is
for
wild.
The most part.
All right, so what I want to know now, like what goes into the prep on a fire day? You know, you get your crew together, equipment that goes into it, like the game plan, like what is that? What does that look like?
You're first and foremost looking at the weather. You got to look at, weather and I guess climate. You got to know your drought and you got to know today, what's my temperature, wind speed, wind direction, humidity, mixing height, dispersion. There's probably a few more, but those are the big ones that I can call off the top of my head right now. It is like throwing a dart at a bullseye because you write a prescription for each unit that you're burning. And the prescription is kind of as it sounds. You describe the area, the objectives, the considerations, both infrastructure and wildlife. And I mean, there's more, but those are the two big ones that I consider. And then you outline, what are the weather parameters that I can burn this in where I feel that I can be safe and effective in my application? For example, we had a unit of basically no burn history, yellow sand scrub. It required temperatures around 95 plus Fahrenheit. Our relative humidity, RH, cut down to like 40 or something like that, maybe in the high 30s. And then our wind speeds were averaging on the ground 8 miles an hour with gusts up to like 15 or 18. In order to make sense or kind of translate that, that meant that I had a canopy of, I want to say, 20 foot tall with these oaks that are all or nothing to burn, getting topped out with a fire that sounded like a freight train running on by.
Wow.
You literally can hear the fire, and depending on how it sounds can determine just how hot and heavy it's running. So the weather is like the biggest consideration for when you're burning an area. And beyond that, like the size of the unit and the complexity will determine the personnel and the equipment that you need. If I'm burning in a marshy area, I might want a swamp buggy in order to be able to access it. Shoot, there might be some areas where I need an airboat in order to get it done. So equipment and personnel tend to be the limiting factors for people to be able to apply fire to an area. And something that you don't really talk about because oftentimes people know, but you want to make sure that you have a burn boss that's experienced enough and knowledgeable enough of the area of fire to be able to apply it safely to the area. That also goes for your crew as well. If I'm burning a very complex unit, I want to ensure that my crew is aware of all the possible hazards, things that could go wrong while you're burning there.
Wow. So what's a good day out there? You know, how many acres are we talking? Are you wrapped up? Is the fire done at the end of the day? Does it keep going? Like, I'm sure you don't want, you know, I've never actually even thought about that. What, you know, you don't want it probably going too long without your intervention. So it's like, what are the goals around the amount, and what do you do to say, okay, we're done for the day? Or do you have people come and refresh you so you can keep going 24/7? I don't know.
Oh, that would be fantastic. Oh my goodness. That'd be a beautiful, perfect world. Like, yep, Jimmy, come on in. Yeah, need you to take over for me.
Tap you in. You go ahead.
Here's the prescription, bud. It's your fire now.
Oh, that's hilarious. So I'm guessing that's not how it works.
No. When you're out on a fire, you're done when the burn boss says you're done.
Okay.
And the burn boss will let you know when you're done. Yeah, you have mop-up standards, and that's identified segments to the planning and implementation and post-burn work that you do with prescribed fire. So mop-up is one of the phases of fire, and it's all just to say that you're doing your due diligence to ensure that the fire stays within the unit. So you don't want altogether too much smoke in near the edge, because that could jump. You want to make sure that there's no chance that it can kind of sneak on through, either through like pine needles that are over the line or even sink on into the duff. I've seen it before. It's insidious. The duff will be smoking and all that, and you're like, oh, okay, it's in there, it's fine. And then you kind of look over here and you're like, oh, well, it must have just snaked underneath the line and popped up over there.
Wow.
Duff's a sneaky, sneaky little jerk that likes to steal time from me. But like I said earlier, I had a 12-hour day the other day. I've been on fires before where we started the fire at 8 a.m. and we were packing up and ready to go at noon. Depends on what resources you have available to you then and there, as well as the composition of the vegetation within the unit. Contiguous fuel is always great, which is why I love palmetto, because it burns, to me, palmetto is so ubiquitous that I think most burners have seen the way it burns and understand it pretty well. So you have something that you can kind of count on to be consistent, not just in the way it burns, but how it burns just across everything. Generally, when you're burning, you are burning during daylight hours. And when you leave the unit, you're ensuring that it can't leave the unit as best you can. But that doesn't mean that the fire is 100% out. It's pretty darn rare to walk away from a unit and have no smoke whatsoever.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, trees, you got logs that'll fall and those will burn. We call those 1,000-hour fuels. And you can have 1, 10, 100, and 1,000-hour fuels. And that's just a way to describe essentially how long they're expected to burn for.
Really? Is that literally 1,000 hours? That's like months and months.
There's... I guess that is.
I have to look up exactly how many hours. I could probably do the math real quick. Almost 42 days. I mean, yeah, a month and a half. I feel like logs could burn that long. Maybe. They're big enough.
You got a lighter knot from a pine tree or a really dense big oak?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can. And there are some... There's some good literature and documentation to explain how they came to like this kind of determination and how they segmented it out. So I'm not gonna pretend to be an expert. I kind of just follow the guidance and training that I've gotten in the past. And yeah, in my experience, a heavy log, I would bet it could probably burn for 1,000 hours. Yeah, because it also depends on the water content of it too. But yeah, you just try and kind of let that fuel load burn out, because it's either going to be a problem later, or it's going to contribute to an organic accumulation in the soil and subsequently increase your risk for duff fires and muck fires.
Well, I'm curious now, once land is burned, what is the follow-up process? Because it sounds like data is obviously a huge part of this, and just kind of one, you know, capturing when and where and how you burn. But two, I'm sure this is when a ton of the research starts to kick into gear and understanding, and like it's really understanding why this is important. What happens after a burn, and what, and also in simultaneously, how does the landscape respond post-burn?
It is crazy. It's fascinating. Post-burn evaluations are an important aspect to your prescribed fire program, because you can't really effectively determine how well things are working if you aren't looking to go back and see what happened. But when you outline the parameters for your post-burn evaluation, a lot of those parameters that you are assessing and documenting were established in your initial burn objectives for the unit. So I know a lot of people are, because flatwoods are a much more comprehensive habitat across the Florida landscape, a lot of people are very concerned with crown scorch on pine trees. Pines they love fire, and it's something they need. You know, those pine needles that they throw down, you see how easy they burn. They're begging for it. So if you have, they're used to fire, and it's good to put it through there. But if you do have a very hot fire that completely consumes the entire crown of the pine tree, you almost certainly killed it. And sometimes that can take a year or two to show. Like, your pine tree might flush out green the next year, and then the year after that it dies. And you can better determine if it's going to die if you assess the crown scorch immediately post-burn. And then that would also lead to potentially implementing follow-up actions, such as planting pines out there. I killed all of my pine trees and it's a flatwoods. I should try and bring pine trees back to that area, because that's how the habitat structure is, how it looks and how it is. For Archbold, a lot of the post-burn evaluations, we will do our initial assessment to determine if we met our goals. A lot of times, especially with scrub, our goals are like 75% to 100% of the available fuel, available vegetation is burned. And so some of our objectives can be completed as we're doing mop up the day of the burn. Some of the other programs at Archbold, like the plant lab program, the avian ecology program, they will do their own post-burn assessments to see how their research might have been affected, to see how these plants respond to this fire. So it depends on, it all kind of comes back to this higher level thing that trickles down to help us determine what the best course of action is. And at Archbold, the higher level thing is to recreate natural ecological processes that can help translate into our research.
Right.
And so I'm not nearly the expert as, you know, like Dr. Sahas or Dr. David. And so they really know exactly what they're looking for and how to document what they need to know for their programs. And so I feel more like I'm a facilitator than
right. No, that's interesting.
Than anything.
Well, let me ask you this. What's one of your favorite things post-burn that comes back or processes?
Oh, quail.
Quail? They, really?
There's so many other things. Like I'm normally a plant person, but I think maybe it's just because I have this poignant picture the other day where I was out burning. And while I'm setting fire to this unit, I look behind me where the fire has already pushed through and I see a covey of quail coming into the unit. I'm like, I'm still applying fire here, y'all. This ain't even done. There's still flames. And you're like, gimme, 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 gimme.
Eat it up.
Uh-huh. Wow. And it's they're known as the firebird. Tall Timbers has a mascot and they call him Burner Bob. And he's a bobwhite quail. It's the cutest thing ever. And it's absolutely a perfect advocate for prescribed fire because they, like, quail numbers decline precipitously without fire.
No kidding. I actually did not know that. Wow. I was at Buck Island yesterday and saw some quail. And I did not expect to see quail yesterday. And that is so cool. I did not know that. Burner Bob. And we just did, I worked for the Corridor Foundation and we just did a mural in Monticello, kind of where Tall Timbers works a lot. And that had a quail featured in it. So that was really cool. I wonder if it was Burner Bob. I should have asked, but I didn't know. That is really neat. That is so cool. So tell me, are you going to be involved with the Fire Fest at all that Archbold's putting together?
Yes, we're holding a long overdue.
Tell us about it. Tell us about it.
So we're in Florida, pyrogenic communities constantly trying to spread the good word of fire because there are a lot of people that aren't exposed to fire and have a stigma against it. And that's just, to me, it's probably counter to the majority of the sentiment, but to me, fire is life. Fire brings life. It's renewal, it's regeneration, it's blooming, it's beauty.
Yeah.
And so a fire festival is a great way to advocate for this beautiful natural process. There are other fire festivals like Jonathan Dickinson, and I think Sarasota County put one on. Yeah.
There was one in the Bahamas a few years ago too. But it was a documentary about it. You remember that? It was called Fire Fest. It was that, it was a music festival that just absolutely fell apart. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It's like this, it was terrible. But anyway, no, it was a joke.
Different process. Yeah,
2017, and it was Ja Rule, the rapper, and it was filled with fraud and poor planning and theft. It was nuts. But anyway, this is not that. This is a different fire festival.
We're trying to put a little more planning in
right,
ours.
Right. I don't even think they had flames. So y'all are going to actually have flames.
Exactly. Yeah, we're hosting the inaugural Lake Wales Ridge Fire Festival at Highlands Hammock State Park on, I believe it's November 8th.
Yeah.
And so we'll have a few speakers to discuss like the cultural history of fire, burning for wildlife, and it'll all ultimately culminate in a live fire demonstration. So if you want to get a little sideline view of what it's like to be on a prescribed fire, well, we're going to be putting one on for people to see.
That is so weather dependent, I guess. I'm sure y'all can get it started no matter what. And that's going to be at Highlands Hammock, I believe,
yes.
Correct? That is so awesome. I am so excited. I have always wanted to be a part of one, and I'm going to go and be a part of this one. So super excited. You're going to be there?
Yes. Yes, I will. I'll be on the Ask a Burn Boss panel.
Oh, sweet. Then we might be, I think I'm doing a live interview there. I'm going to be a little more prepared and like try to, you know, come from it. So it'll be interesting to see who's going to be in the crowd and attending, because we could frame the questions around, you know, who's there. But that's what I really want to know. I mean, just the way you're talking, it sounds like this is just such a, there is so much to know and there's so much left to know. How do you feel? I mean, is this something you see yourself doing, you know, forever and learning about forever? It sounds like you love it enough that it could be. Is this something that you can do a long time? I was talking to Gene earlier today, Gene Lawless at Buck Island, and no pun intended, but he got bucked off a horse and hurt himself. And there's like, at some point, a cowboy has to hang up their saddle. How about with burning? Is it something that you can do for many, many years?
I am really hopeful that I can. I've seen some burners that keep on trucking along, and it's something that brings a little youthful vigor to you. Whether through excitement or fear, you're going to get moving.
You're good.
I do feel that I can make a career out of it. There is a physical toll that goes on, but so long as I'm not treating my body too poorly, I think I can make it.
Right. It's I loved basketball, but it's not good for my knees anymore. But I like biking too, so I can ride my bike forever. You know, if you see that, that's something that are pretty easy on the joints. Well, I got a couple last questions. Was there anything else that, you know, even before Firefest, because I'm sure we'll talk about it then, anything you would really like people to know about the work you do, whether that be fire or with any aspect of land management? Is there something, a message you're always trying to get across that you feel like you want to reiterate here?
I mentioned it before, but the biggest thing is Florida will burn, whether it's prescribed fire or wildfire. And when we're applying prescribed fire to an area, we're doing our best to mimic natural processes and to reduce fuel load and therefore increase the safety of people that may live next to a wild area. Please support prescribed fire. It benefits everybody to have it.
I love it. Before we ask the last three questions, I got to know, what's the craziest thing you've seen out there burning?
Oh man, gosh,
I'm sure there's plenty of stories of things that you like would prefer to not see burning, whether that be wildlife, you know that it happens, but there's stuff like, ah, that's sad, I wish it could have been different, but there's surely got to be things that you like leave your head scratching like, what the heck, I did not expect that today.
There, I think we've burned a few times where bullets that were unspent went off.
Oh my gosh.
We've also burned in areas before where something exploded. I couldn't tell you if it was a propane tank that somebody threw out. But
it vaporized, you're used to people before getting... you could tell.
Yeah, having bullets where there was no noticeable source come flying at you really, really puts you on your toes.
Oh my gosh, I can imagine. That is wild. That is cool. Well, let me ask you. You know, you're someone that's seen a lot of different places in Florida, and you've seen some places that people will never get to, just with the work you do. What's a place in Florida that's special to you? Is there anywhere that stands out? People have answered everything from their favorite spot to fish or a specific memory or just a type of area they really like, or, you know, that people have just said Florida. So do you have an answer to that question?
I'm going to be a little basic and then I'll drill down. Okay. But my basic answer is the Lake Wales Ridge.
The Lake Wales Ridge.
It's the best. Ridge rat right here.
Someone asked me yesterday, like, what do you call people that live on the Lake Wales Ridge? They're like Ridgeites, Ridgettes. Like, what is it? Do we have a name?
like to call us all Ridge Rats. But...
Oh, see, that's my favorite one so far, Ridge Rats. I like that. I'm going to hold on to that one. You need a tattoo.
Scrub surfers, maybe. But I love the Lake Wales Ridge. You've got wildlife that are found nowhere else in the world that have been here for thousands of years. Sand skinks, you can't find those anywhere else. It's like their global distribution is a handful of counties in the entire world. There's a plant called Oryngium cunifolium, wedge leaf button snake root is the common name. That's only found in one county in the whole world.
Wow.
And that's Highlands County on the Lake Wales Ridge. As far as some like spectacular areas to really check out and see some gorgeous varied landscapes of the Lake Wales Ridge, because we aren't just scrub. We talk about it a lot, and it is bay, but there's also some pretty choice seepage slopes and wetlands and all that, like cutthroat. But if you want a chance to see those, the Lake Wales Ridge State Forest and the Lake Wales Ridge Wildlife Environmental Area are two gorgeous places. Absolutely beautiful. I would wholeheartedly recommend that if you want to see some scrub, go to like the walk in water unit of the Lake Wales Ridge State Forest. Arbuckle Tract is also great. That one has a great juxtaposition of like cutthroat seeps next to scrub. And then like Carter Creek of the Lake Wales Ridge Wildlife Environmental Area. Beautiful. There is a lot of restoration fire and general restoration work that was done there in the last few years, and it shows. It is beautiful. Gotta see it.
That is cool. I grew up right against the Arbuckle Tract of the Lake Wales Ridge State Forest, or Lake Wales State Forest, right?
Lake Wales, yeah.
Okay. And I'm like, wait a second. Yeah, and because there's so many areas connected, but yeah, that it's so beautiful. And now I go home, I'm over in the Bradenton area. Gosh, it's just like a kid in a candy shop every time I'm there. It's so gorgeous. I'd have to agree. It's probably one of my most favorite areas. Just incredible.
It's a good opinion.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's a great opinion. Great opinion. And there's so many cool little spots, and my mind goes to a little spot called Lake Godwin that's out there. That's this little dock. Oh. It's just picturesque and just always quiet and can't hear traffic, and you can hear the wind going through the pine needles, and I just love it, and I just took it for granted growing up there. Now it's like, God, I wish I could just go back and spend all the time in the world I had. Well, what's a way that people can get involved? I know we're going to point them to coming to the Fire Fest on November 8th, but you know, outside of that, you don't want people picking up drip torches, you know, right next to you that have never done anything like that. But like, what are ways people can get involved in the work you do?
If you want to get directly involved with prescribed fire, you could pursue the minimum certifications that are generally required to participate on fire. Those are gained through the National Wildfire Coordinating Group, NWCG. And like the basic one is your S130, S190. And there's like a couple other acronyms and numbers. You could pursue volunteer opportunities with maybe a local land managing agency or nonprofit, especially if you have those certifications. But ultimately, if you're not feeling up to that, or if that's not necessarily how you want to support prescribed fire in the area, advocating for it is a big thing. A lot of naysayers are more vocal in their opinions on prescribed fire. And so I wonder what kind of change might happen if those that were supportive of prescribed fire advocated for it at county meetings, at management plan meetings, you know, a lot of the government agencies are required to come out with a management plan for an area. And in the process of creating that management plan, they will have an open house to hear from the public on what it is that they might like to see on this land, or any kind of potential like use or prohibitions on use. And part of that could be advocating for more prescribed fire. So yeah, advocating for it in your regulatory agencies and just generally on social media or in public. Sometimes too, biologists aren't necessarily known for being charismatic or gregarious. So if you have somebody that's inclined that way, helping to knock on doors and let neighbors know and provide them with information on a prescribed fire program for a specific area, that's huge. Public support, just generally from the public, but especially from the neighbors, helps ensure that we can continue to facilitate these processes.
Great answer. That's awesome. And lastly, what gives you the most hope about the future of Wild Florida?
I think having a lot of attention on, and it's ironic, but on the loss that we're experiencing daily of good habitat. You know, a lot of people, you're saying you live in Bradenton now. That place has changed just in the short, what feels like the short time that I've been in the area. People see what's happening, and I think they're realizing that we need to protect these green landscapes and these green spaces, not just for our peace of mind and general view, but for clean water, for clean air. And I'm hopeful that people understand that. And it, especially with like the Wildlife Corridor Act going through in Florida, they recognize that we are Wild Florida and we want to stay Wild Florida. Yeah, that's kind of that's really the big thing. I'm happy to see acquisition happen and continue to happen. And yeah, I want to keep seeing it.
Well, there you have it, folks. Alicia, like I said, badass, right? Am I right? You can learn more about her at Archbold's website, and please come to Firefest Saturday, November 8th, 10 to 5, Highlands Hammock State Park in Sebring. And please be there for the live podcast recording at 1 o'clock. All right.